Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, September 10th, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we'll be debating birthright citizenship. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, we're recording today's call for use as a podcast in the future. We're going to hear opening remarks and then a little bit of back and forth from each of our two experts. We'll hear first from Professor John C. Yu. He's the Emmanuel S. Heller Professor of Law at the University of California, Berkeley School of Law in California. And he'll be followed by Dr. John C. Eastman. He's the Henry Salvatori Professor of Law and Community Service at Chapman University School of Law. With that, Professor Yu, the floor is yours.
Dean, thank you, and thank you to the invitation from the Federal Society to participate in this podcast. And I also want to thank my good friend John Eastman. We've been friends for about 20 years now, I think. I was thinking about this. I think we first met 20 years ago as young law clerks, and I think we agree on a lot, but this might fall into that 5% of issues where we disagree. But it's always great to debate with John. It's always challenging, and I usually learn a lot. So I want to just set out the basic view about why I think American law and our historical tradition support the idea of birthright citizenship, and then say, and then before John speaks, maybe lay out some of the reasons why I think the counter-argument is not consistent with the Constitution's text and history. But if I don't get to that, I'll get to that after John lays out his case. So I think the first off, the Constitution, the original Constitution, before the 14th Amendment, does not itself define citizenship. It assumes citizenship because it makes it a citizenship requirement for offices like the presidency, Congress. In part, though, you might say it already does have the assumption that birth in the country grants citizenship because, as we all know, the president has to be a natural-born citizen. But so before the 14th Amendment, the Constitution, federal law itself, did not set out a single definition, but the historical evidence and state practices before the before the Civil War show that birthright citizenship was the rule, because this had been the common law rule in England, and the United States by practice adopted it. The reason that the 14th Amendment was necessary, of course, was because of the Civil War, and parts of the 14th Amendment were meant to override specifically Dred Scott. Now, Dred Scott had a lot of problems, a lot of mistakes in it, but one of them was that Chief Justice Taney found that freed blacks could never become citizens. Actually, slaves could never be citizens either, and so overturned the idea of birthright citizenship. And I think the part of the 14th Amendment, I think it's hard to read the 14th, it's curious to read the 14th Amendment then as narrowing the previous American rule to be liberty narrowing, when in fact I think if you look at the overall purposes of the 14th Amendment, the way it operates in other clauses like due process and equal protection, the point of the 14th Amendment was at a minimum not just to overturn Dred Scott and this mistaken view of citizenship, but also to expand rights. And part of that was to make sure that states and politicians could not monkey around with the definition of citizenship in order to punish or favor one group or the other. So look at the 14th Amendment's text. The 14th Amendment's text, I think, is quite clear. It says, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. I think if the phrase, that second clause, subject to the jurisdiction thereof, were not in the text, then we wouldn't be having this debate, because not just on this podcast, but in our politics and in the Supreme Court and so on, because it would just say clearly, just anyone born or naturalized in the U.S. is a citizen. So people who criticize the tradition of birthright citizenship have to place, I think, all their eggs in the basket of that phrase, subject to the jurisdiction thereof. And it has to be read as meaning allegiance to the United States rather than allegiance to a foreign country. I don't think that that language bears that kind of interpretation. I think the more straightforward interpretation is that subject to the jurisdiction thereof means people who are subject to American law. That, I think, is consistent with the use of the phrase jurisdiction elsewhere in the Constitution. You know, if you look at places like Article 3 of the Constitution, which defines the jurisdiction of the federal courts and so on. And, however, it doesn't mean, this reading doesn't mean that that phrase means nothing. You could, then that, because we have to read, as Chief Justice John Marshall said, every word in the Constitution to have meaning. I think subject to the jurisdiction thereof sets out, it refers to three different categories of people who could be on the territory of the U.S., but it would not be subject to the laws of the U.S., and those would be foreign diplomats, enemy soldiers, occupying U.S. territory during wartime, and these two, first two categories are obviously very, very small. And then the third one, which would be the major category in the minds of the framers and afterwards, would be American Indians on their, you know, on their territory. They're still semi-sovereign states governed by their own laws, and they would not be considered under the 14th Amendment citizens at birth. So one other point I was, because I'm just sort of getting towards the end of my first period, is that this is not just some, I think, radical reading or something that upsets American tradition. I think this is the one that's quite consistent with American tradition, and I think is the rule that the Supreme Court, not in these recent cases like Plyler versus Doe, but in an older case from the late 19th century, so that this was a rule affirmed by the Supreme Court in a case called United States versus Wong Kim Ark, which was decided in 1898. This was the case of a child born on U.S. territory to Chinese parents. The Chinese parents themselves could never become American citizens under the Chinese Exclusion Acts, which I, you know, for whatever it's worth, I thought was a terrible piece of legislation. Then, the, when he's older, Wong Kim Ark leaves country. I think he was visiting China, and then he comes back, tries to re-enter, and a federal, I think, customs official blocks him at the my city, the city of San Francisco right here, to prevent him from coming back in. He's saying he's not a citizen. He's barred by the Chinese Exclusion Acts. The Chinese Exclusion Acts had made it, had tried to stop Chinese from emigrating to the U.S. any further, and also said those that were already here could not become citizens. Both of those powers, by the way, within, I think, Congress's powers. There was a Chinese Exclusion Act cases, and Congress, of course, has the power of naturalization. And the court there said that even though the parents couldn't become citizens, the child was a citizen because he was born on the territory. And it's true that in this case, the parents were legally allowed to live here, but if you read the case's opinion, I'm sorry, the court's opinion, it doesn't really turn on whether the parents are legal aliens or illegal aliens. It just makes the case just turns on where was the child born. And the court calls birthright citizenship the ancient and fundamental rule of citizenship in the United States, that if you're born within the allegiance and protection of the country, that you are a citizen. Doesn't really turn on where the parents are from. Now, that was something that the dissent in that case made quite a strong issue over. The court, the dissenters actually, I think, raised many of the arguments that have come down to us today and are put forward by critics of birthright citizenship. So one last thing, let me close, is just as a policy matter, you know, I think constitutional law and what the policy matter, policy issues should be are, of course, separate. But in my mind, I think I don't see why this should be such a big issue in our fight about immigration policy. I think that if you look at the numbers, the number of children born to illegal aliens in the United States is not actually that high. I don't know about the exact count, but I think it's in the single digits as a matter of percentage. I think that the real question, of course, is immigration policy with regard to the parents, the illegal aliens coming into the country, not their children. I think obviously when it comes to immigration policy, we have to do more to secure our borders, make sure that we control our territory. That is a definition of sovereignty. But on the other hand, I think that a generous immigration policy is one of the things that makes America exceptional. I think one of the reasons we have this debate is because the American rule is such an unusual rule. Many other countries, those particularly in Europe at the time of the Constitution and since, followed the different rule. The Roman law is called jus sanguinis, the idea that citizenship comes from blood, from the citizenship of your parents. And the United States follows a very different rule, the jus solis, the birthplace determines citizenship. And I think there's a lot of things that may go into making America an exceptional country in the world, and this, I think, happens to be one of them. I don't see why, at this late date, after all of this history and tradition, there is such a big urge to overturn, I think, what in the end is actually a distinctively American rule. So, John?
All right. Well, Dean Reuter, I want to thank the Federal Society as well, and also my good friend and colleague, John Yu, for engaging in this very important debate in such a civil manner. He and I traded swords blows over at the National Review and have thousands of comments, mostly thoughtful, about the subject. I have to say that the level of thoughtfulness there far exceeded by orders of magnitude the scurrilous comments over on the same debate I had at the New York Times. And so a different testimony to the competing readerships. Here, let's try and find out where we agree and then where we disagree and probe this a little bit. So I think where we agree is that the language of the 14th Amendment and not subject to the jurisdiction thereof is the critical language. If you remove that language, the 14th Amendment would be very clear. All persons born are citizens. That would be clear. And so we have to ascertain what and subject to the jurisdiction thereof means. We don't have to speculate about it because the drafters of that language are actually asked that very question in the debates of the 14th Amendment. And before I turn to those debates, I want to point out another aspect of this that I think John and I agree on. And that is because there were not restrictions on immigration in 1868. There was no such thing as illegal immigration into this country. It's very clear that they are not talking about, in the 14th Amendment at all, what's to become of children of illegal immigrants. And so we have to draw out from the debate they did have, by analogy, what the meaning of this clause would be to that different circumstance that they were not contemplating when they drafted it. And so this is why the debate over what's to become of American Indians is so critically important. Because the subject to the jurisdiction language, while it may be perfectly clear to us in 2015, actually had two different meanings in 1868. And so the question they were pressed with is, which of the two meanings are you intending to convey by putting that language in the 14th Amendment? The two meanings were this, and I'll give an example of how just modernly we would think about this to show you the two meanings that they had in mind and that they were debating. It can mean complete allegiance owing or political jurisdiction, or it can mean partial or what they called territorial jurisdiction. So here's a modern example. Suppose a citizen of Great Britain comes to visit the United States on a vacation. While he's here, he's subject to our laws. He has to drive on the right side of the road rather than the left side of the road, which is the law that applies in Great Britain. And if he violates those laws, he can be ticketed for violating them. Just as anybody else who's here more permanently can be. He is therefore subject to our jurisdiction in that partial sense because he's subject to our laws. But he's not subject to our jurisdiction in the more complete sense. He's a visitor. He doesn't owe allegiance to the country. We don't draft him into our army. He doesn't serve on juries or get the right to vote. He can't be prosecuted for treason if he takes up arms against us, because he's not violating any oath of allegiance to us. He's not subject to our more complete jurisdiction. And so those are the two meanings of that phrase, and we have to try and ascertain which one they intended when they adopted the 14th Amendment. Because the other thing that John and I both agree on is the public meaning of the words by those who ratified that amendment is what ought to control. We're both deep originalists on that. And so it's very important that we roll up our sleeves and figure out what they meant. And so those that were critical of the language and trying to stop it in the debate pressed the issue by asking Senator Lyman Trumbull, who's the kind of prince of key guy on the 14th Amendment more broadly, and Senator Jacob Howard, who's the actual author of the Citizenship Clause when it's introduced in the Senate. And they're asked, well, what about Indians? They would be covered by this, wouldn't they? Because they are most clearly subject to our jurisdiction, both civil and military, Senator Trumbull was asked. And he responded that subject to the jurisdiction means subject to its complete jurisdiction, not owing allegiance to anybody else. Senator Howard says the same thing. He said it should be construed to mean the full and complete jurisdiction, the same jurisdiction and extent and quality as applies to every citizen of the United States now. Now, what is he talking about? Well, the now is the language of the 1866 Civil Rights Act, which they had passed just the year before, and they were deliberately trying to codify in this constitutional amendment. And that language makes the point even more clearly. All persons born in the United States and not subject to any foreign power, excluding Indians not taxed, are declared to be citizens of the United States. That's the language that they had used to overturn by statute the Dred Scott decision, and that they are now codifying in the 14th Amendment to make sure the Civil Rights Act of 66 was upheld as constitutional. There was some question about that, but also to prevent any future Congress from repealing it. And that language makes patently clear that we are talking about this complete allegiance-owing jurisdiction, not the kind of jurisdiction that comes from being temporarily here as a visitor, and certainly not the kind that comes from being here illegally, that is, not without permission or consent in the first place, not subject to any foreign power. So we might say, well, wait a minute, that's not the language they use in the 14th Amendment, and therefore the 14th Amendment broadened it. But no, the only thing we can glean from the debate on that change of language is the concern that Indian tribes were not a foreign power, but a domestic power, and that language not subject to any foreign power had started to give some cause for concern, and since the Indians were subject to a different power, but it was a domestic power, they really weren't excluded except for that exclude Indians not taxed. Let's just get rid of that altogether and just say, and subject to the jurisdiction. And somebody says, will that cover Indians? And say they said no, because they don't owe their complete jurisdiction to us. They owe their jurisdiction to the tribe. And therefore, an amendment to add in language excluding Indians not taxed was defeated because it was not necessary. It was redundant. That was already covered by the subject to the jurisdiction thereof language. That is pretty clear. And so those that argue that subject to the jurisdiction means simply subject to the laws have that huge problem in dealing with Native Americans. Now, the other problem is the concern about the children of diplomats. Well, technically, we don't need the subject to the jurisdiction language to cover them at all, because under the international law, fiction of exterritoriality, it's called, diplomats are not even considered to be residing within the United States. Because the territory of their sovereign follows them wherever they go and follows their children wherever they go. So we don't need the subject to the jurisdiction thereof language to exclude the children of diplomats. They're not even born within the United States. They don't meet the first clause under this fiction of extraterritoriality. And so unless this subject to the jurisdiction clause did something more than that, it truly is redundant. This does not narrow the grant of citizenship by the 14th Amendment. It codifies and replicates exactly what they had done by the 1866 Civil Rights Act. Now, let me go further, because we don't have to limit with my trying to glean from those debates that are admittedly not directly on point in dealing with the children of the illegal immigrants. We've got several contemporaneous decisions, both in dicta and in holding by the Supreme Court and also by the leading treatise writer of the day, within a decade of the 14th Amendment being ratified, that take exactly the same position. Thomas Cooley, who I think everybody agrees was the leading treatise writer of the day, the constitutional treatise writer of the day, in his treatise, he says, dealing with what the subject to the jurisdiction language means, He says it means the full and complete jurisdiction to which citizens are generally subject, and not any qualified or partial jurisdiction, such as may consist with allegiance to some other government. Well, that included Indians who had allegiance to their tribe. It included what they called temporary sojourners. Those are people who are just merely visiting the United States on a brief visit. And it would certainly include those who are here illegally and who retain their allegiance to their home country, to pick up on Thomas Coolidge's language. Now, when the Supreme Court first addressed this in 1893 in the Slaughterhouse cases, I'm sorry, 1873, in the Slaughterhouse cases, in its dicta, because this was not the holding of the case, but they had to grapple with what this clause meant. And here's what they said. The phrase subject to the jurisdiction was intended to exclude from its operation children of ministers, consuls, okay, there's the diplomatic piece, and citizens or subjects of foreign states born within the United States. That can't be more clear. Now, that's only dicta, and it's not binding. But that's what the Supreme Court, which just in a few years after the 14th Amendment was ratified, said that that clause meant. That dicta becomes holding a decade later in the 1884 case of Elk versus Wilkins. Elk had been born on a tribal reservation. He renounced his allegiance to his tribe, and he claimed that he was a citizen because he was subject to the jurisdiction. The Supreme Court rejected his claim, said because even though he was subject to the laws of the United States at birth, he was not subject to the jurisdiction as intended by the 14th Amendment, which requires, quote, that he be not merely subject in some respect or degree to the jurisdiction of the United States, but completely subject to their political jurisdiction and owing them direct and immediate allegiance. He didn't meet that test because his primary allegiance at his birth was to his tribe, not to the United States. Now, take that by way of analogy. The primary allegiance of people who are here unlawfully in this country remains to their home country. And in fact, the largest share, although I think Chinese immigrants to this country has just exceeded Mexican immigrants, I'm told. I haven't verified that number. But the largest share prior to that of Mexican illegal immigrants, Mexico makes very clear that their citizens, even though now living in the United States, continue to owe allegiance to Mexico, and Mexico continues to claim the allegiance of their children as well, just like Elk and Elk versus Wilkins continue to owe the allegiance to his tribe. And so this understanding is therefore codified in the 14th Amendment. It's reaffirmed by the Supreme Court in the first two decisions looking at it, what have you. Now, John's right. Wong Kim Ark, the 1898 case, says otherwise. It says, no, the 14th Amendment adopts this doctrine of jus soli, an old common law doctrine. And that's clearly what the dicta of the case says. And it's clearly the reasoning for the holding in the case. And so I don't dispute any of that. I think the reasoning of the dissent is better. But if we're to take Wong Kim Ark as binding precedent, we also have to distinguish between the reasoning of the case and its dicta and what the actual holding of the case is. And the holding only goes so far as the facts of the case allow. And the Supreme Court routinely does this, even though the reasoning would take it much further. If they think the reasoning is wrong, they will limit the holding of the case to the actual facts of the case. And the actual facts of that case were, as John adequately described, that Wong Kim Ark was the child born in the United States of lawful and permanent residence in the United States. The Supreme Court uses the technical legal phrase domiciled. They were here domiciled in the United States. That means they weren't just temporarily visiting here on a student visa or a tourist visa, and it also means that they weren't here illegally. They were domiciled. They had taken up lawful residence, and in fact, they had done everything that they could to demonstrate their new commitment to their new country that we would allow them to do. And here's the real critical point here, and why this notion, this old common law notion, is so incompatible with the basic principles of the American regime. We refuse to let Wong Kim Ark's parents renounce their allegiance to their Chinese emperor, even though that is a fundamental human right. It's the very fundamental human right that we articulate in the Declaration of Independence. And so let's go back and look at what this jus soli doctrine really is and why it's so incompatible with American founding principles. It's not that if you were born on the soil, you were a citizen. The old doctrine of jus soli is a feudal doctrine. If you were born within the king's allegiance, you forever were the king's subject, and you could not even renounce it. That was the doctrine. It wasn't about citizens, it was about subjects. And it was about owing allegiance to a king that you had perpetual allegiance to, and you could not renounce it. So what do we do in the Declaration of Independence? Everybody agrees that most of the English common law carries over to the United States when we become our own nation. But the Supreme Court has repeatedly said, except for those parts of the common law that are incompatible with the basic precepts of the Declaration of Independence. Well, we have to test whether this aspect of the common law is incompatible with the basic precepts of the Declaration of Independence. And it's incompatible in several fundamental ways. First of all, our declaration does not recognize subjects. It recognizes citizens based on the inherent equality of man. The second thing is it doesn't recognize that whatever allegiance was owed by being born on the king's soil could be perpetual. And the Declaration of Independence is the most eloquent and profound rejection of that doctrine ever written in the annals of human history. It begins right at the first paragraph by saying one people has decided to separate themselves from another. That can't happen under the common law doctrine of jus soli. And then it concludes with a very formal claim that these states are and of right ought to be free and independent nations or states, and that they hereby renounce all allegiance to their former government. That was not possible under the doctrine of jus soli. So we fundamentally reject this doctrine right there at the core of the Declaration of Independence. And it's that rejection of jus soli, this perpetual allegiance, that we violated by signing this treaty with the Emperor of China and signing the Chinese Exclusion Acts. So it's no surprise that the Supreme Court, when confronted with that fundamental incompatibility of our law with our principles, would recognize the citizenship of Wong Kim Ark, who was born to parents who were lawfully here, permanently here, legally domiciled here, and just we would not recognize their ability to take the next step, which our own declaration said we should have recognized. Now, should we stick with the broader dicta that says no matter how you're here, you're born on U.S. soil, illegally overstaying a visa, becoming part of a birth tourism industry or whatever? Should we say that the Constitution already mandates automatic citizenship for them? Well, here I'll close with this, and I know I've gone on a little bit long. If John agrees with me that this particular issue, that whether the children of illegal immigrants are automatically citizens, was not discussed at all, other than by way of analogy, not discussed at all in the 14th Amendment debates, should we assume that the 14th Amendment actually closes the door on such a fundamental policy dispute that the Article 1 of the Constitution otherwise gives plenary power to Congress over? Normally, we don't assume such things by silence. And so if we agree that there is silence on the particular question before us, do children of illegal immigrants get automatic citizenship by virtue of this clause of the 14th Amendment that was drafted when they were not contemplating that issue, then I think the better course, even if you disagree with my reasoning by analogy from the Indian cases, the better course is to leave it open question subject to the policy judgment of Congress, where we otherwise assign that core responsibility to determine naturalization and citizenship policy. Let's leave it there. Let John respond, and let's get some questions in. And I think there are a lot more details we'll probably cover in that aspect as well.
Well, thank you, Professor Eastman. Let's hear again now from Professor Yu.
Yeah, thanks, Dean, and thanks, John. I'll keep it short so that we can get to questions in the, I guess, 30 minutes we have left. Just one thing about the 1866 Act, I think, which John placed quite a bit of emphasis on. John's quite right that the original draft of the Act guaranteed birthright citizenship to anyone born in the U.S. except those, and then the quote was, subject to any foreign power, unquote, and Indians not taxed. And so one question that occurs to me is, if the 14th Amendment text is actually just codifying this 1866 Act, and the reason the 14th Amendment did this was because there were questions about the constitutionality of the 66 Act, why didn't they just repeat the phrase? Why did they change subject to any foreign power, which would clearly create the rule that John wants, to much more I think from his perspective, ambiguous and contested language subject to the jurisdiction. Doesn't make any sense, it seems to me. The second thing, if you want to go through the legislative debates, you know, of course, the legislative history here is not conclusive one way or the other. There's different passages that seem to stand out for either side. But I do think it's not quite right to say that the framers were not thinking at all about the illegal alien, what we would call today the illegal alien problem, or you know, children being born to people who weren't citizens. You know, there's a well-known passage where the leading opponent of the citizenship part of the amendment, a senator from Pennsylvania, asked the managers and supporters of the amendment, he said, "Is a child of a Chinese immigrant in California a citizen? Is a child born of a gypsy born in Pennsylvania a citizen?" And the senator from California at that point responded yes, and he thought it was quite clear. And he would lose his seat, actually, in his next election because of rising opposition to Chinese immigration into California. He lost his seat because of this stand. So I think, yes, there are there's a lot of debate, actually, more about the 1866 Act, I think, that stands on John Eastman's side. I do think there's debate on the other side in the legislative history that supports the more traditional rule. The second thing is, I guess, before I close, it does seem to me odd, this reading, though, because this reading, in a way, restores the theory of citizenship that is the problem with Dred Scott. And you can say there's two different theories of citizenship that are possible or that are expressed in this debate. And I think the one John's promoting is what you could call consensual citizenship, or maybe a republicanism version of citizenship, which is that citizenship is by agreement between the state and the citizen. And that's particularly the case with republics rather than a monarchy where you have subjects. But the different view is this birthright citizenship. Your citizenship is not based on consensus. I think the American rule is a little different because American rule allows for what we call expatriation, for the giving up of citizenship, which was not something that was really permitted in the common law pre-American in the British conception. It seems to me odd that the 14th Amendment's drafters, who are overturning the mistakes wrought on our constitutional law by Dred Scott and by slavery, would adopt a theory of citizenship which had not been the American rule, which had been the one that had been created by Dred Scott. My sense is, just going back and looking at the history of how citizenship worked between 1776 and the 14th Amendment, or between 1776 and Dred Scott, as far as I can tell, there are no states and there are no federal laws that are using the consensual view of citizenship. They all follow that British approach, the common law approach of birthright citizenship. So I don't think it's inconsistent with the idea of the Declaration of Independence or our framers. In fact, it's the framers who actually wanted to and did keep that rule, even though they created a brand new republic. It's interesting, you know, those framing debates are interesting, the debates afterwards are interesting. There are people who actually do want to have something like John's reading of the 14th Amendment. I think the leading proponent, from what I saw, is Thomas Jefferson. And it's very interesting, though. Jefferson did not want to allow this kind of birthright citizenship, because not because of slavery, although that might have been going on in the back of his mind, but more because he didn't want the, I think he called them the, you know, sort of uneducated masses of Europe from coming over here, who were not educated in republicanism and would be, members of, you know, products of monarchies and the civil law, coming here and, spreading their bad ideas about how government should be run. So there were people at that time who wanted to get rid of birthright citizenship, but they failed. My sense is the uniform practice at that time was birthright citizenship. And so it was Dred Scott that marred that. It would be weird, I think, for the 14th Amendment to change that rule back. So I would actually say I don't agree with John in that the 14th Amendment's text and the Constitution leave this question open. I do think they're foreclosed, and I think there's an important reason why. And it's an important reason why the Constitution does foreclose other important issues like, whatever, free speech, religion, and so on, equal protection. from the political process, because there are certain kinds of issues we don't want politicians or even our own elected representatives from picking and choosing amongst winning groups and losing groups, or favored ideas, disfavored ideas, favored religions and disfavored religions. And I think the framers of the 14th Amendment saw that Dred Scott opened up that possibility that our elected representatives could use the idea of consensual citizenship to play, pick and choose favorites amongst different groups, different nations. Let me close by saying I do think that John is correct that the main focus of the legislative history debates of the 14th Amendment, a lot of the thinking and writing about it after the 14th Amendment, had to do with Indians. But I don't think the rule on Indians governs, and I think India is a very unusual area of law and a very unusual problem in our law and constitutional at this time, but I don't think that should be used to foreclose birthright citizenship for immigration, where I think the practice had been fairly settled. And the 14th Amendment was just restoring that understanding.
Thank you very much, Professor Yu. Professor Eastman, I do want to get to questions, but I want to give you a quick minute to
Let me take up a couple of points. I do think John rightly focuses on this very interesting exchange between Senator Cohen and Senator Conness, but I think he's got the nature of that exchange exactly wrong. Senator Cohen was a bit of a racist. One has to concede that, and he says you're going to give citizenship to Chinese and Gypsies, and then he asks this, and this is very interesting. Have they any more rights than a sojourner in the United States? Now, what does that question assume? It assumes that sojourners are not going to get automatic citizenship. That's exactly the point between territorial and partial jurisdiction on the one hand and complete jurisdiction on the other that I'm trying to make. His point is you're going to give citizenship to Chinese children, Chinese who are here lawfully and permanently. It's a racist question. He's trying to say, you know, we understand we're overturning Dred Scott, but we're not going to otherwise open up this citizenship to all these other races like the Chinese. Have the children of Chinese domiciled in the United States any more rights than a sojourner, he asks. And it's to that question that Conness says, no, it doesn't matter what your race or your skin color or your ethnic background is. If you're here lawfully, permanently, I'm putting that part of the words in his mouth, but that's what this question assumed. If you're here lawfully and permanently, your children will be automatic citizens. We are not going to just extend this citizenship to the children of white Europeans plus the children of slaves. It's much more than that. But that says nothing about whether somebody who's here merely temporarily, and certainly says nothing about somebody who's here unlawfully. If they continue to owe allegiance to another sovereign, then they are not automatic citizens. That's what's clear from the debate. And the change from the 1866 Act to the Constitution, John can speculate about it, but they were very clear because there was an amendment to add in excluding Indians not taxed. And that whole discussion focuses on the fact that subject to the jurisdiction means exactly not subject to any foreign power, with the removal of the word foreign simply to handle the fact that the Native American tribes were domestic powers, not foreign powers. There was no other hint in that debate that what they were intending to do is give automatic citizenship for anybody who can manage to get here illegally in order to have a child. None whatsoever. And so the real question is, does therefore in its silence or ambiguity, does the 14th Amendment foreclose to the Congress the ability to make fundamental policy judgments about what has become one of the three leading magnets for illegal immigration in this country? And think about how crazy it is. We give Congress the power to define what our immigration policy shall be. The power of naturalization is the Supreme Court has called a plenary power, and the power over international or commerce and the other powers from which we derive the power over immigration as well are plenary powers of Congress. And so Congress, even though the United States remains the largest lawful immigrant country in the world, we allow more immigrants to this country every year than all of the rest of the nations in the world combined. But the notion that it has to be completely unfettered is crazy, and Congress gets to put restrictions on it. in the notion that they get to put restrictions on it, but then they can't do anything about the magnets that would encourage or entice people to violate those restrictions is just crazy. And yet that's what this understanding of the 14th Amendment that has taken root ultimately means. And I'll close with this. When did that understanding take root? Well, it didn't take root after the 1898 Wong Kim Ark case, because for decades later, Congress is continuing to offer grants of citizenship to large groups of people, Native Americans, but also others, who were born on U.S. soil. So they didn't think that the birth was enough, whatever. There was a massive guest worker program in the 1920s. Largely from Mexico. When that ended with the Great Depression, there was a huge repatriation of those guest workers, including anywhere between 500,000 and 1.2 million children who had been born to those workers while they were here. And I have been looking, and there is not a single case that I have been able to find where anybody made the claim then that the children were citizens and therefore couldn't be repatriated to Mexico because they weren't citizens of Mexico. Nobody made the argument. Same thing's true of the Braceros program in the 1950s and 60s. When it came to an end and the Braceros left back for Mexico, I don't find any evidence that any of them at the time made the claim that the children who were born here while that program was underway were citizens. In fact, the passport office in the 1930s and 1940s and 1950s didn't change until 1966, required for you to get a passport, proof that you were born here, but also proof that you owed allegiance here, which was a different requirement for the passport to be given to treat you as a citizen. That language gets bureaucratically changed in 1966 without any change in the 14th Amendment, without any change in the statutory authorization, just kind of some bureaucratic filling in of a form idea. So the notion that this has always been the rule in this country is just not true. It kind of came in through bureaucratic fiat in the 1960s. It then gets picked up in a footnote by Justice Brennan, one of the most liberal justices ever to sit on the Supreme Court, in the case of Plyler versus Doe. We have no Supreme Court holding that the children of illegal immigrants are automatic citizens by virtue of the 14th Amendment. And quite frankly, I'm glad we're having this debate now, because I think it's long time past that we sort this issue out. Quite frankly, the very ability of this sovereign nation to control its borders and to retain its sovereignty is at stake if we don't get this question right.
All right, we've got some time left. Let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone while we're waiting to see who might ring in. Let me ask a quick question, maybe of Professor Eastman, but for either of you, actually. The language subject to the jurisdiction thereof, we've been talking about that a lot. It seems to center, at least in Professor Eastman's mind, on total allegiance. And I take it the allegiance of a newborn, we're talking about the allegiance that's imputed to the newborn from the parents and their legal status in this country. I'm wondering if there's any thought about another clause of the Constitution that's been mentioned here today. Article 2, Section 1 says that no person except a natural-born citizen or citizen of the U.S. at the time of the adoption of the Constitution shall be eligible for the office of the president. Now, was that language adopted because it was assumed that a newborn, somebody born outside the U.S., would have some sort of allegiance to that foreign country, even if they later became a citizen of this country? And
yeah, so,
what does that say about the allegiance of a child born in this country?
Well, I think your question, Dean, is based on a misunderstanding of the Natural Born Citizenship Clause, and it's the same misunderstanding that I think John has about it. Now, the Supreme Court has never addressed what that clause actually means, and many people assume it means natural-born citizen means born on U.S. soil. That's not what it means. What it means is, are you a citizen at birth, or were you subsequently naturalized? And you can be a citizen at birth in one of two ways, born on the U.S. soil and subject to the jurisdiction of the United States at the time of your birth, or born to U.S. citizens abroad, and therefore through them owing allegiance to the United States from your birth. What the distinction the natural-born citizen clause is aiming at is, did you owe allegiance to another foreign power and then subsequently become naturalized and change your allegiance to the United States? And so it doesn't answer the question how you got that allegiance from birth to the United States, whether born here and subject to their jurisdiction at one route, or born to American citizens abroad. So I think people like John McCain, born in the Panama Canal Zone, Ted Cruz, even Barack Obama, if he was born in Kenya, as some people apparently still think he was, because they were born to American citizens, they were citizens from the time of their birth, not subsequently naturalized. And that makes them natural-born citizens and therefore eligible for the office of president.
Okay. Professor Eastman, anything on this before – I'm sorry, Professor Yu, before we go to the audience?
No, I don't. I hadn't thought through, but I think this issue about the natural-born citizen clause – but I think one reason I don't think it turns on this is because – the 14th Amendment clearly also sets out a floor. So no matter what John or I think the 14th Amendment text requires, it seems, I think, that Congress can define citizenship at birth more broadly than the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment, in other words, is not a ceiling for who can become a citizen.
Okay.
And on that, we agree. Yeah, we just disagree where the floor is, but we agree on that.
We've got three questions pending and a few minutes left, so let's take our first call of the day.
Good morning. This is Tom Getty. Both professors, thank you for coming and talking on this. I had a question for Professor Yu, whether it changes your thinking at all or your reasoning on the 14th Amendment to look at the powers of Congress in dealing with the Indian tribes. In 1887, the Allotment Act, and then the follow-on 1906 issuance of Patent and Fee Simple Act, Congress provided, and at that point, by the way, about two-thirds of American Indians were citizens, and about one-third were not, and they were citizens through different mechanisms, including marriage to non-Indians and property ownership. But included in that, and it sounds terribly racist, but there was the Adopting Habits of Civilized Life in the 06 Amendment that provided that an Indian child born in the United States of citizen Indian parents is born to citizenship. Doesn't that sort of implicate that, and also there was the legitimate children born of Indian woman and white citizen father were born to citizenship. This is 1906. Doesn't that sort of send the signal that Congress has the ability to grant or deny under that notion of what is subject to the jurisdiction of the United States?
Well, Tom, thanks for the question. I have to confess I haven't read those acts of the extension of different rights to Indians. I do think, though, that it's not clear to me why we should take the Indian example and draw from it the principles that have to apply to children born to aliens. And there's two reasons why. Well, first, I think the Supreme Court in Wong Kim Ark doesn't do so. And as you say, by the time of Wong Kim Ark, there had been these trends towards granting Indians more and more citizenship. And then I think second, Indians themselves are such, and this is my broader point, is I think the treatment of Indians is such a unusual and unique problem. It's recognized right from the beginning by Chief Justice Marshall, who had a very hard time trying to define what they were. Were they really sovereign nations? Were they, dependent people? He calls them something like semi. He basically comes up with a rule: they're semi-sovereign in a strange way. I mean, they make treaties with the United States. They as like independent nations would, but they're within our territory. And one thing that happens in the late 19th century along with those acts that you mentioned is that Indian tribes begin to transfer in their status from these kind of seven semi-sovereign nations to lose their sovereignty, to become more like what they are now, whatever that is. And they have that kind of status that's unique in our law. There's no other right, there's nobody else, there's no other groups that are treated so differently because of that, from the beginnings, from our framing and the difficulty in identifying their legal status. And I think it's even fair to say that the framers weren't exactly sure when they wrote the Constitution how to think of and legally treat aliens. But in this late 19th century period, a lot of other things are going on. For example, during this period, the frontier closes, Indians become subject to the Department of the Interior, basically, and not anymore towards a State Department. We actually stop making treaties with the Indian tribes, and we start passing laws just to regulate them in a straightforward manner. So all that's going on in the late 19th century. I'm not an expert in these two laws that you mentioned. But again, I think that this central problem of how to treat Indians and whether to think of them as citizens, I think is a very distinct problem and different than the one of aliens. And I think one problem with the 14th Amendment debates that that John and I have discussed is that most of the debates and most of the discussion we're talking about with citizenship had to do with Indians. And that when they discussed aliens, they didn't discuss it that much. And I don't think they make clear that this idea that they have to be, that you have to be, that the parents of the child have to be U.S. citizens or somehow resident aliens in order to be born. In fact, one way to see this is that they didn't even have this concept of illegal or illegal aliens because there was no general federal immigration law during this period. And so that's why Wong Kim Ark, I think, doesn't even really address this, because they wouldn't have thought of it as, birthright citizenship or not turns on whether your parents are illegal or legal aliens, because they wouldn't have thought of parents as being illegal or legal aliens. People just could enter the country and were just here as residents, and then their children would just, according to Wong Kim Ark, would be considered citizens. So, the short answer is I'm afraid that I don't know those laws, but I don't think the treatment of Indians should be the precedent that governs the birthright citizenship of the children of illegal aliens.
And I've got a different view from the same evidence, that the case for citizenship for the children of Indians, at least those born off the reservation rather than on the reservation, you can treat the reservation as a separate sovereign territory in some sense, even though it was within the broader boundaries of the United States. But the children born off the reservation, the claim for them to be citizens is even stronger, because they owed allegiance, immediate and direct allegiance, to the tribe, but the tribe by then was owing allegiance to the United States or was subjected to the United States. So they had a stronger claim for citizenship under John's interpretation of the 14th Amendment than the children of people who are here unlawfully in the first place, who had no direct or indirect allegiance to the United States. And so I think that discussion actually strengthens my argument on how this would play out, not weakens it. And then I think the final piece that John admitted they don't even conceive of the idea of illegal immigrants. So they never confronted the problem. And then the notion that therefore the 14th Amendment has completely foreclosed Congress dealing with this problem, when the people that drafted and ratified the 14th Amendment didn't even have it in mind, is a very, I think, bizarre understanding of what the constitutional mandate is, that we've made up a mandate to deal with circumstances that were not within their within their thought. And in fact, to the extent we can try and tease out what their thought was, we're contrary to their thought. And yet, nevertheless, it's going to be a mandate that prevents Congress from making a significant policy judgment to deal with a huge problem. And I'll go back to something John said at the very beginning, that it's a relatively small problem. It's not. 500,000 children of illegal immigrants are born in this country every year and being treated as automatic citizens. 70, 80, 90% of hospitals along the border, birthing rooms, are to illegal immigrants. We have entire industries now growing up on birth tourism, where women are coming from all over the world to spend the last month of their pregnancy here to have the child born and then get the holy grail of United States citizenship and then go back and be raised in their home countries without any allegiance or connection to the United States whatsoever. This is becoming a huge problem, and it's a threat to our ability to control our sovereignty. And the assignment of how to deal with that program is not by the 14th Amendment, when this was not even within their contemplation. The assignment of the power to deal with that problem is quite clearly in Congress, and we ought to get the 14th Amendment's understanding correct to free them up to confront the policy difficulties that we have.
And then can I just to respond very briefly to the policy issue there? I think I don't think that birthright this birth tourism industry, or the 400,000 or 500,000 births a year are the problem. They're a consequence of the problem. I do agree that sovereignty means controlling your borders. If you really want to control your borders, it's not that the babies are being born here, it's that the parents who are coming in are getting through the border in an illegal manner, and that the real problem over sovereignty is just controlling the border. It is true that there might be a few hundred thousand births to illegal aliens in the country. That's a very small percentage of the overall number of births in this country, and it's a very small percentage of the number of illegal aliens in the country, which is, I mean, the count's all different. Sometimes I see figures like 12 million, maybe less, maybe more. But if it's 200,000 or 300,000 births a year, or even 500,000 births a year, that's a very small number compared to either aspect of the problem. It's the consequence, because it's the parents who are illegal aliens coming through in a non-legal status who then get in, and then they have the children here. If you want to actually restore sovereignty or keep, the question is then to have an effective control of the border and to be careful about who we decide to allow in or not. I have to say, I think that John and I probably both agree that our immigration system is broken. I would be in favor of having more effective control of the border, but I actually would be more in favor of increasing rather than decreasing the number of aliens who are allowed in, and then the number of people who go from alien to citizenship. But whatever those numbers are, I think the illegal the births to illegal aliens is a very small number compared to all these larger problems we have with immigration.
But part of the problem, the system is broken and the border is not secured. Part of the problem is because we're contradictory in how we treat these things. So we pass restrictions on immigration, and then we don't enforce the laws against employment. That's incentive number one. We don't enforce the laws against providing social welfare services to illegal immigrants. That's huge magnet number two. And then we give out a birth certificate that it becomes as treated as citizenship and a holy grail of the children. That's huge incentive magnet number three to violate the laws that we're trying to implement to secure the border. And so the reason our system is broken is because it's incoherent, largely because of these contradictory pushes and pulls on what those incentives ought to be. And I'm asking that we confront the incentive of birthright citizenship as well as the two other incentives and get them right, and then maybe we can control the border. And then if once you've got it controlled, you've reasserted your sovereignty, then you can make judgments about how many people in any given year can we welcome, we're still the largest in the country, how efficiently can we do it so that we don't get swamped with people who owe allegiance to foreign countries, who have habits of despotism, the way Jefferson talked about it, and are not yet accustomed to free government. There's an assimilation to be required for the true exercise of free government. We don't want to be swamped with people accustomed to living in despotic regimes, because that would influence the nature of our regime. And those are the kind of policy things, and you've got to have the incentives line up with the policy judgments that are being made. And this mandatory automatic citizenship, erroneous interpretation of the 14th Amendment, has handcuffed Congress in addressing those incentives properly.
I just want to say on this, as like so many other matters, I am glad Jefferson lost.
All right, we've got some more questions pending. Let's try and get another call in here, if we could. I'm going to ask the caller to be as succinct as possible, please.
Larry Joseph in Washington. I was wondering if you could answer the historical question about English common law. So the Kim Art case looked to diplomats and people invading armies, that sort of thing. Was English common law at the time that if someone ducked over from France to England, had a baby, and then ducked back? I mean, what was the citizenship of that child? Did they owe fealty to the English king?
Yeah, there's go ahead, John.
No, John, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, there's some dispute about it. And in that dispute, we have seed for our own War of 1812. Right. This is the English king continued to impress American sailors that were captured on the high sea and put them on British ships, saying, "Well, you were born in the United States at a time it was our colony, so you still owe me allegiance." They could have made and did often make the same claim of the French. Of course, the French rejected that claim and said, no, there are citizens. So it was a hotly contested point of dispute. And I go back to saying this is the point of birth citizenship or birth subjectship, to get it more properly, that we explicitly renounce in the Declaration of Independence.
John, you anything on this?
Yeah, although I have to say, I don't think there's any. I think that's accurate as to the description of the British common law at the time of the framing. I don't think, though, there's any states or any practice from the early period which suggests that though such a person would not be considered a citizen of the United States. You know, someone had come from another country. I mean, someone's parents had come from another country. They remained citizens of the other country. And then you're born here, that you were not considered a citizen. I think that just from the histories I've seen of the practice of immigration during this pre-Civil War period, you know, post-Republic, post-Revolution, pre-Civil War period, is that people in the United States followed the British common law rule, even though if it did create this repatriation, you know, the problem that John's focused on is not necessarily the problem about the birthright citizenship, it's the problem of repatriation, is whether you can and how you lose that citizenship. And so in the United States, we have this combination where you have birthright citizenship, but also you have the ability to renounce that citizenship.
Yeah, you know, it's a little more complicated than that. Yes, in the antebellum period, from the Declaration up to the Civil War, people were generally treated as citizens if they were born here, if their parents had come here. That was all that was enough. But that doesn't mean once you think about it, we've adopted birthright citizenship. Think about the circumstances. You didn't come to the United States for a week's vacation, right? When you came here, that was like you left everything behind. You were never going to see your relatives again. This was the transatlantic ship ride was you know, all but irreversible, you know, for most people. And so when you came here, you had chosen to make yourself American. And we have implicit consent because we are desperate to populate up these shores at a time when, if we don't do that quickly, we're going to be, you know, subject to the salivating claws of the various European powers wanting to regain their foothold on the North American continent. So the fact that we treated everybody who came here and their children as citizens doesn't answer the question, given the circumstances of the time. It's much more complicated than that.
Well, I would say, though, that, John, as you said, and I think, you know, and I agree that there were people at the time of the framing who did not want to have birthright citizenship. But, you know, Thomas Jefferson is not just a sole person, but his view, you know, which you invoked you know, for the argument in favor of, you know, due attention to how much we can assimilate in immigration levels was, I think, he wasn't the sole voice. And he thought that, he basically said, I don't want to have a lot of immigration from he calls them the servile masses of Europe. And he thought that, you know, bringing in people from monarchies would disrupt this sort of homogeneous, peaceful, republican nature of the American people. I think that view never took hold in the period between the founding and the Civil War. No, I don't think it did. If you look at practice, there's no practices.
Your point is different.
Your point is that they didn't have illegal aliens at that time that anyone could just come in. And so,
But they did understand that they needed the population, so they rejected Jefferson's view on the short term. But they also recognized that they would probably need to control it at some point. And that's why they gave Congress the plenary power over naturalization to make those policy judgments at the time.
Over naturalization, but you don't see anything in the Constitution or anything in the practice that suggests that the birthright citizenship part of it is something that's given over to Congress too. And I think that you might make a good argument that to have a fully coherent immigration policy, you want to have a consistent view on border control and then work, the ability to work, and then birthright citizenship. But I don't think our Constitution permits one to have the same policy as to all three. And so it doesn't mean, you're saying, you know, part of your argument is that, well, the framers didn't anticipate the problem of illegal immigration because there was no illegal immigration. There was just immigration. And so why should we read the 14th Amendment to foreclose it? But that's a different way of saying it is the 14th Amendment just foreclosed making distinctions based on immigration status for birthright citizenship of their children, And if we today have a problem that didn't arise, we have to figure it out in a different, figure out the solution in a different way. But the constitutional text just doesn't allow us to do it in that one way. So I would say if you can't get the results you want through regulating birthright citizenship, then you have to be more aggressive in terms of border control and employment.
Well, gentlemen, we're technically out of time. We've got some questions pending. Do you have time to take perhaps one more question, or should we adjourn?
Yeah, I can do another one.
I think one more is okay.
Okay.
Hello, this is Nate Montenegro, Federalist Society member here. I have a question for Professor Eastman, but I would like to hear the opinion from Professor Yu as well. Following the argument of the subject to the jurisdiction thereof, would that apply as well, or can we apply that as well to the other clause of the 14th Amendment, which is the Equal Protection Clause, which says no state shall make any law which shall deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws, so as to allow Congress to pass constitutional laws that would classify the children of undocumented immigrants and their parents might as well, based on religion, based on race, based on gender. I would like to hear their point on that.
Yeah, so I think the difference between the language of the two clauses is significant, and I think it supports my position. The Citizenship Clause says subject to the jurisdiction. The Equal Protection Clause applies to persons, not citizens, and it's all persons within the jurisdiction. Now, within the jurisdiction is clearly a reference to this idea of territorial jurisdiction, within the borders. If you're within the borders, then you get the protection of the laws. That means if somebody assaults you, the police are supposed to give you as much protection as they give to a citizen or somebody else within the borders who's assaulted. You're supposed to get the equal protection of the laws, and that applies to any person who was within the jurisdiction. The Citizenship Clause says all persons born here, that would be anybody within the jurisdiction. And then subject to the jurisdiction, that's where I think it conveys this higher idea, as they specifically said, the more complete jurisdiction, not just as applies to anybody who is within our borders. And that's the distinction, I think, that I've been trying to make. And I think when they were asked about it directly, that's the same distinction that the drafters of the Citizenship Clause language claimed they were making.
Professor Yu.
Observation here is that it seems to me then the real word that John is placing the weight of his argument on is not really the phrase jurisdiction, but it's the phrase, the difference between what is subject to mean versus within jurisdiction. And I think that it just seems to me that in the constitutional text, if you were not to look at legislative history or practice and you just looked at the text as a whole, I think that that'd be an odd reading, because jurisdiction, I don't think anywhere else in the Constitution has this idea to it that jurisdiction is about allegiance to a country rather than just the power of the government to subject you to its laws, which I think everyone agrees is at least one basic meaning of jurisdiction, because that's the way I think it's used in places like Article 3, the Constitution, and so on. And so I think regardless of whether what the meaning of subject to versus within, whether that means where it means in terms of territorial jurisdiction, it seems to me jurisdiction itself bears the meaning of subject to the power of the laws, not allegiance to in terms of citizenship.
Well, gentlemen, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it right there. We've got some questions pending. This is an issue that's going to stay live for quite a while, so perhaps we can have both of you back to carry on the discussion at some point in the near future. But I want to thank you both for your comments and for fielding questions today. To the audience, thank you as well for dialing in and for your questions. A reminder to our audience to check our website for the next scheduled Teleforum conference call. We're adding them every day. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.